This is Dana Monsees, the nutritionist and Whole30 certified coach behind Real Food with Dana, and you're listening to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. All right, time for another episode of the podcast, guys. You're listening to Real Talk with Dana, and I'm your host, Dana, obviously. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called Real Talk with Dana. Anyways, this week's guest is Whitney Stewart. She is a dietitian in Dallas, Texas, and she is also one half of the Whole30 Dallas Duo coaching squad. And despite the fact that both Whitney and I are Whole30 coaches and the September Whole30 is rolling around, we're not actually going to be talking that much about Whole30 today. We're going to be doing a deep dive into the culture of gluten-free and celiac and a lot of the myths that dietitians and nutritionists have to bust and why we should be focusing more on mindset around food rather than the exact foods that people are eating all of the time. But first, two updates for you guys before we get started on this interview with Whitney. So, September is rolling around, which means that I have new individual nutrition client spots opening up. So, if you have been dealing with adrenal issues or GI stuff, or you really need some help with your relationship with food and your body, maybe you're trying to get away from counting macros or counting calories and you're just not sure how to do it, or you think you might be stuck in a cycle of overexercising and undereating and maybe you have some metabolic damage going on and you're not sure what to do about it. Or maybe you just have a ton of underlying health issues and food sensitivities, and again, you don't know what's going on, you feel like you've tried every last thing, and you just don't know what to do. I am your girl, so I've got a couple of spots opening up for the fall, but I know they're going to fill up fast, I guess. So if you're interested, shoot me an email at realfoodwithdana@gmail.com, all spelled out, or you can go to my nutrition services page on my website and fill out the contact form at the bottom, and I will send you my new client intake form, and then we can decide if we want to start working together. And then the second update is, because we're at the end of August here, and that means that the giant September Whole30 is rolling around. If you are thinking of doing a Whole30 and maybe you've never done one before, or maybe you've tried to do it multiple times, but you haven't really finished it that well, or maybe you finished the 30 days and you did really well, and then you just kind of fell off the wagon, or now you've done them before and your sugar dragon is raging and you just don't know how to get to this elusive food freedom thing where you don't feel like you have to do Whole30s or a Whole30 reset every single time you want to get control of your sugar cravings, your energy levels, your digestion, your skin issues, all of that stuff. I am running a 7-week Whole30 group coaching program. There's going to be an in-person one if you're local to DC, and there's going to be an exclusive online component. So there's an online group if you are not local to DC, because I would still love to coach you through it. Get more details on that at dcwhole30.com. I'll include all of this in the show notes. I won't bore you with any more about my coaching programs. And now let's get to the interview with Whitney. So we are going to be talking about Whitney's personal health journey of getting really sick and wanting to become a dietitian, why a celiac diagnosis is a blessing and a curse, obviously, because you can't ever eat gluten again, RIP. But we're also going to talk about when going gluten-free, why it's so important to cut out not only gluten, but also gluten-free processed foods if you really want to heal. Then we're going to talk about the biggest nutrition myths that Whitney has to bust for her dietitian clients and why, and this is going to be all about sugar and carbs. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the Whole30 because, duh, Whitney and I are both Whole30 coaches and we both run Whole30 group coaching programs. So we wanted to talk about what it's like to be a part of one of those group coaching programs and honestly why we think it's so beneficial for people. And spoiler alert, it's because of the mindset piece. It's not because of the food. And another spoiler alert, this is just one thing that Whitney and I were talking about. Dietitians and nutritionists, most of them anyways, if they're balanced, do not eat the way that we are prescribing for our patients all of the time. For example, I do not eat Whole30 all the time, and nor do I recommend that for anyone, as you guys have probably noticed since you've been listening to my podcast. But anyways, enjoy the episode with Whitney. So I would love to start if you could share your story, your personal health and fitness journey, and then why you wanted to get into working in nutrition as an RD.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my story like really kind of starts back in high school. I was like a really healthy kid on paper. I didn't go to the doctor very much. And then my senior year, like everything went wrong. Like they thought I had mono. They couldn't figure out what was going on. And it was like one diagnosis after the other. And it just seemed like one day my body just decided to reject everything. And then from then forward, it just wouldn't really accept anything that I was normally eating. So for a kid that had been raised on a dairy farm and who was Swiss, like dairy and like gluten and grains and corn and beef were like a huge part of my diet. And so I kind of started this like journey of figuring out like why I was kind of like vomiting like after every meal, and like sick and bloated and swollen. And you know, my parents were like, oh, you're bulimic. And I was like, I don't know how to make myself vomit, so like if you can help me figure out why I am, this would be really helpful. And so all of the main, you know, like Western medicine doctors that we'd gone to kind of had their own idea of what it was. Consequently, I was going to college that same year. And so it was just this really interesting experience of how I was seeing doctors like in Seattle. We had to drive like an hour and a half to get there. And then I was slated to go to school in Dallas on this academic scholarship. And so I was flying back and forth to see doctors who like didn't have answers. They eventually like did an endoscopy and diagnosed celiac, which was great, except I had moved to Dallas and everything is fried.
Yeah.
Full of gluten. And it didn't seem to resolve some of my issues. Like I had lost 15 pounds in 2 months. And I was still chronically like tired and didn't know what was going on. And so then it was a naturopathic doctor that I met with who eventually said like, hey, I think you actually have some other food allergies and some underlying inflammation as well going on, and even possibly like leaky gut like symptoms that are causing more issues than just celiac. And so as the very popular freshman in college, I went on a medical food diet for like 3 months.
Oh,
where I was like living off of like rice protein powder and lettuce pretty much, and just to figure out like what was going on. And she was really helpful. I think the first person who like listened you know, to me saying like what I felt, and it was the first time I had really had to deal with like why food was making me feel bad and what that felt like. And you know, that like indigestion wasn't normal and like bloating after a meal wasn't normal, kind of all came around like that first year of college. So
yeah, I think that's one of the craziest things is, you know, whenever you get a diagnosis or whether you're making some kind of dietary or lifestyle change where you start to fundamentally feel different after making that change, like when you get a diagnosis of celiac or an autoimmune disease and then you start to cut out the foods that you realize are negatively affecting you, you realize that, oh, I don't always have to feel bloated or nauseous or have all these digestive issues. Like, this is not normal. Which, I mean, nobody really, when you're growing up, like no one says to you like this isn't normal, you know, unless you're consistently seeing doctors or something.
No one teaches that as a child, like the basic understandings of, you know, like how long you should chew or like how slow it should take you to finish your meal, or you know, at least not in our household. And that was really interesting to me because my family, looking back now, like so many of them deal with digestion issues and have like prevalent allergies. Like it's obvious, you know, like, oh, like I eat that and it makes my nose drip. And I'm like, that's a clear sign that there's something wrong. But they don't see it like that. You know, they're like, oh, I can have ice cream and it makes my stomach hurt, but it's not an allergy. And so kind of think having that new mindset and having somebody else say that it was okay to not want to feel that way and have that standard was really enlightening.
Right. I mean, if we think about common examples, like people say beans are the musical fruit,
yes,
right? They just,
yes,
you know,
it's like, no.
Right. But that doesn't, that's something that's accepted as normal and like it just happens, but that doesn't mean that it's optimal, right? And then the same thing with, for example, red wine. If it gives people like a headache immediately, that doesn't, maybe you should try white wine, or maybe you should try, you know, cutting alcohol out for a while and then reintroducing it and seeing if you still have those symptoms. But it's so curious that we just accept these things as normal because no one talks about it when we're kids. In the same way, I was actually thinking about this yesterday. It's kind of similar to, you know, religion, politics, nutrition, and then like pooping, right? No one talks about those.
No one talks about
because they're just not pleasant conversation, I guess. Which is funny because when you're a little kid, you don't care, right? You know, you're like, ooh, no, poop is funny. Like, but maybe someone should be telling you that it's normal to have a bowel movement every day, you know, maybe once or twice a day, and they shouldn't be, you know, on the one spectrum of consistency, and they shouldn't be extremely hard to get out either. But kids, no one really talks to them about that, unless you're a very enlightened parent, in which case, props for you.
Yeah, and, you know, I think I had very few friends who were like, oh, my parents were, you know, like a GI doc. I had, you know, a close friend. I'm like, well, that's awesome, because she got the full spectrum of, you know, what she should expect at that end. But otherwise, even now, you know, I have my parents text me about like GI stuff, but they won't really talk to me because they're, it's just not PC in our culture to really talk about those things that matter. You know, that was what was interesting to me too. Even my journey is that I had doctors say like, oh, take this medication, make you feel better. And there were multiple times where it was me doing my own research on symptoms saying, hey, like, this makes me feel really lethargic and I feel sick and I actually feel worse than when I started. And they're like, oh no, it'll get better. And it, you know, it never did. And it was like these heavy drugs, in the same way that like people weren't talking about it in today's culture. Like, if I take this med, it actually makes me feel worse. It was just accepted that if your doctor gave it to you, you should just take it.
Right. So then what else did they figure out was going on in addition to the celiac and leaky gut?
So I have lactose intolerance, which I kind of always knew, but like that cultural norm, it was just accepted that like I would eat it because I was Swiss, like farm girl. And so I needed to consume dairy. So just like figure it out. And then I also had a beef and corn allergy. And so 80% of my diet was like made of these things. And Whoa. So when I cut them out, one, it was super hard at first to even understand what to eat because that was all I knew, really. Like looking back at my dinner plate, like it was mostly that. And then just figuring out like what a balanced diet looked like to sustain myself. And then getting back on track from like just being on this clean slate of medical food, like that wasn't sustainable either.
Yeah. And then one thing that a lot of people don't realize until you really go through it is when you get a diagnosis of celiac, it's a blessing and a curse because you can't ever eat gluten again, which like RIP, that stinks. But then at the same time, a lot of people, especially now, it's really easy to do this. You can just shift from eating regular bread, regular pasta, regular, you know, toast and cereal and everything, to shifting to eating the same exact diet, but with all of these gluten-free alternatives, which if you have, if you've just had a diagnosis of celiac, you have a lot of inflammation that's going on. And if you're eating a lot of these grain-filled, even though they're gluten-free, like still processed foods, basically,
that can continue. Usually have like 30% more sugar.
Right, exactly. And it can continue to cause more inflammation. Like obviously not as much as the gluten is going to cause because that's an autoimmune response that your body's having. But if
it's still not going to heal your body from where you're at.
Right, exactly. So what were some of the things that you learned when you were going through that process of healing?
So I was diagnosed in 2009. So the world as we know it now, like gluten-free is so easy to find. Like my husband jokes that like we have gluten-free paper, you know, like everything is gluten-free in our households. But what's really interesting is that at that point, like nothing was really labeled gluten-free except at like the co-op that I shopped at in Seattle. In Dallas, there was virtually nothing. Like I remember when the first restaurant opened that had gluten-free options on their menu.
And that like, was praise like, hallelujah.
Yeah. That was like not till 2011. And we went to their soft opening. And so it was interesting to me because at that point, Like, I think I started to do it right. Like, I was eating like broccoli, and then I was eating like just like chicken breast and like salmon and tilapia, like very simple cooked things. I had to email the cafeteria every morning and tell them like when I was going to be there so that they could like figure out how to feed me,
because
Dallas
gosh.
was so confused. But it was like baked sweet potato. It was like very simple, very bland, but it was like a good way to go. And then that year, Elizabeth Hasselbeck came out saying that she was making all these gluten-free products and that she had been diagnosed with like a gluten allergy. And the market just took off for like all these things finally kind of coming out as gluten-free, and that maybe gluten-free was the answer, and that maybe gluten-free was more of like a, you know, weight loss tool. And that's when things started getting tricky, is that I had all these like crackers and cookies and gluten-free dessert, sugar-filled things in my home that I probably wouldn't even eat on a normal basis anyways. I was eating a really like grain-heavy diet previously, but not like a sugar-heavy diet. And so like the 15 pounds that I had lost, I started gaining back in a different way because of that inflammatory diet that was so much more prevalent in our culture today.
Yeah, and that's actually very similar to me. So I went to school in Vermont, so hippy dippy, kind of like Seattle a little bit.
Yeah,
and I
for
saw
sure.
a naturopathic doctor too, and she was like, you probably have celiac or gluten sensitivity. So I started figuring things out after being sick for a while in 2010, and we had the same thing. We had a little co-op in Vermont, and I would go there and read all the ingredients and everything. And like you said, there wasn't really anything that was gluten-free product-wise that was labeled that way. So you kind of had to stick to real foods, because the very limited options that were gluten-free bread or something tasted like actual cardboard.
Oh my gosh, it was
cardboard. So bad. It was so
like in
gross.
That like plastic container, when you cut it open, it was like,
yeah,
and it like fell apart.
Yeah, it's kind of like how, you know, people used to associate different vegetables with being totally gross, because when they grew up, they were just soggy and from a can and stuff, like Brussels sprouts. That's kind of how we felt about gluten-free breads and products and stuff when they first came out. But now, I mean, with the advent of, you know, paleo becoming super popular and keto and everything, I mean, you can find a gluten-free vegan bread, cupcake, whatever, or keto and paleo breads and pancakes and everything. And just because something has a label that means it, that says it's gluten-free or says it's keto, doesn't mean that it's necessarily healthy and has a place in your diet every single day.
No. And I think that that's like the funniest part, is that, you know, my clients are always like, oh, well, I found this gluten-free, you know, like you're saying, like egg, soy, dairy-free. I'm like, oh, is it sugar-free? And they're like, what? And I'm like, oh, it's made of 100% sugar. This is great. And I'm like, oh, yes, it's allergen-free, but it's not sugar-free. And that is something, you know, that like sugar isn't considered even an allergen, or like something that's inflammatory, is huge for my patients. Like, they do not understand that, because, you know, mainstream media today says like gluten is the devil, but it's not sugar. You know, that's the issue. And that's what's added to all these products, because we know that gluten is the thing that holds bread together and gives it that fluff. And so without it, like, there has to be something to replace that for your mind to accept it.
Yeah, exactly. So I know you just mentioned that you're seeing patients. So when did you figure out that you wanted to be a dietitian?
So that year, like going through everything I had, I was going to school for OBGYN. Like, I was like super passionate about just working with women in general. And I knew that I wanted to do something that was like patient centered and patient focused and to help people. And I had worked in a clinic in high school, and I just loved it. And that year, after my diagnosis, I got really sick, and I had a really great, you know, naturopathic that really helped me through and listened to me. And that same year, the OB that I worked for sat me down and said, like, hey, I need you to realize that since like you are pursuing this, you need to know about like healthcare and insurance and what it's like to work in this, and kind of gave me a more realistic view of what it was to work in that field. And it made me kind of rethink things. And then as my body started to heal, and, you know, like, I found Mel Juwan's blog, and I found Whole30 finally, and I finally found real food, that paleo way of eating that made me feel good, I started thinking, like, how amazing would it be to really use this experience and to have my health journey affect someone else. And so consequently, SMU that year opened a physiology program to pair with my pre-med degree, and there was a nutrition class. And so I jumped in. I was like one of 12 to go through this program for the first time, and it was kind of just meant to be.
That's awesome. So what is the training like that you have to go through to become a dietitian?
So I think it's a little different for everybody. It depends on if you do your bachelor's or your master's in nutrition first. And I knew that the bachelor's requirement was going to become something that wasn't enough to fulfill the needs for my board exams and to sit for the RD. And so I decided to do my undergrad in pre-med and physiology. I felt like nobody would listen to a 22-year-old dietitian. I felt like I needed more basis than that, and I really liked math. And so I still wanted to be able to do a math minor and really pursue some of the science background that I wouldn't have if I had just done nutrition. And so I did my undergrad, which was kind of the pre-med requirements that we see with like PT, OT, PA. We were all in the same classes. We all took that kind of fundamental biochemistry, OChem 1, OChem 2, physics, physiology, anatomy, anatomy 2, all the labs. And then from there, I went to UT Southwestern and Medical School, had a health professions master's of clinical nutrition program. And I rotated through there for 2 years, along with doing 1,000 free clinical hours of work.
Yep, I had to do exactly the same thing.
to fulfill the needs for the program. So I was, honestly, so blessed to be like where I was and everything happened, because the program was coordinated, meaning I didn't have to apply for an internship, and I got to rotate through like 8 different hospital systems with like the best doctors and the best teaching hospitals here in Dallas. I didn't have to move. And it was just a really great experience, where sometimes with the internship, you find that you do all your hours at one hospital. And so you never get to see like the difference between them and the ways of working with different healthcare teams and the collaborative approach, which I got access to.
Yeah, it sounds like a PA rotation when they're in their last year of school, when they get to try out like all the different fields. That's so cool.
And there's very few coordinated programs in the nation. I don't think I realized like how few there were at that time when I was going.
Yeah, for our program, I just had one internship with one supervisor to get all of my hours. We also worked in a clinic at school for 2 semesters where we saw all of our own patients, and we worked, with them one-on-one for nutrition. And then we had licensed nutritionists and doctors on hand to help supervise and provide recommendations and stuff. But that would have been so cool to rotate through all those different fields and work with different kinds of doctors and stuff.
And I think that was, the big thing was I was so, kind of nervous to go from like one hospital to another, because it is like you kind of get in your routine and then you switch up again. But it was so enlightening, because I saw like so many different patient cases, and not just that, but like the way that doctors handled them. And that's like the big thing that I see now is, bedside manner, how patients are cared for, how the team works together, if they do, if they don't, and then just specialty cases that I wouldn't have been exposed to if I had just stayed at one place.
Mm-hmm. So are you working in a hospital now?
No, I left the hospital finally. I never thought I would, but I left the hospital 2 years ago. It was really hard. I really loved ICU. I loved working with the team that was so hands-on. But in terms of growth, I just felt like it was better to leave. And I pursued working in an outpatient clinic with an endocrinology team that's just really heavy on diet and lifestyle changes, which we know for diabetes is so important and so relevant in their care.
That's awesome. So when you're working with patients, what would you say some are the biggest nutrition myths that you have to bust for people, and why?
Ooh, okay. Well, my clinic had some dietitians who worked here before they retired who did education and training a little bit differently. And so I've like 60% of the patients that I see, not in private practice, but in my clinic, I've almost had to retrain in that they don't understand that carbohydrates that sugar is a carbohydrate. They think they're different. They think that, like, sweet potatoes do not raise their blood sugar, but that potatoes are the devil. Or, like, these trendy foods that we see now. Like, the quinoa is the answer to their problems, but they know they can't drink orange juice. And so there's, like, these little, like, misnomer carbohydrate myths that they don't fully understand, like, that big picture educational understanding of, like, which foods fall into which macronutrients, just because of the, like, prevalent fad diets mm-hmm. that America markets and that no other culture does.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I remember, I think a year ago, explaining this to my dad because, so he's a lawyer in DC and they had a routine. I don't know if they were a nutritionist or what they were, but somebody came and they did some blood work. They did triglycerides, like HDL, yeah. LDL, and blood pressure and stuff like that. And
no one knows what those are.
Right, exactly. So he came back and he gave me his results, and his triglycerides were high, and he was like, well, it might be because I drank a glass of milk beforehand. Like, well, okay, first of all, you know you shouldn't have had anything right before that test. They told you to fast. And second of all, why are you drinking a glass of milk before you go into a blood test? So he's like, what do you mean? So I went through with him and explained, like, we went through a day of eating, and I broke down what the foods that he was eating into the different macronutrients so he could understand, because the woman that met with him said you need to decrease your intake of simple carbohydrates and increase the complex carbohydrates. And to me, you know, that sounds like good advice, but at the same time, this is someone who has no nutrition background whatsoever. So how are they supposed to know what that means? Like, she didn't even give him a sheet or anything. And so my dad was and is still kind of one of those people who follows the standard, not even fad diet recommendations, but just, like, general healthy eating guidelines, the, you know, low-fat yogurt in the morning with granola and fruit and orange juice, and then a sandwich and an apple or something with lunch, and then, you know, basically is hungry all afternoon, and then has, I mean, sometimes he doesn't even eat dinner and he just, like, goes to town on the Costco size hummus and pita chips, which I always make fun of him for.
Like, but I don't eat dinner. I just snack for 6 hours.
Yeah, exactly. So, oh my gosh, it was crazy. And so I broke all of those down for him and I was like, Dad, every single thing that you've eaten today, every single thing is mostly made up of carbohydrates. Like, yeah, there's some dairy there's some fat in the dairy. There's some protein in the dairy. There's, you know, depending on what you had on your sandwich, there's a little bit of fat and protein in there. But the majority of the things that you're eating are all carbohydrates, which are broken down to your body into sugars, which if you don't use them immediately for exercise, then it's stored as body fat. And it was just this huge light bulb realization that he had.
And your triglycerides.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, he's a dad and he's like, oh yeah, like I have a glass of wine like every other night, or, you know, happy hours with work and stuff like that. And, like, again, that's something else that is converted down into carbohydrates, into sugars. And whenever you drink alcohol, that's the first thing your body metabolizes, and everything else is shunted to be stored as energy for later, which that is stored as body fat. And he's just like, what? Like, you know, mic drop, mind blown kind of thing. And it's these kinds of very simple realizations that can make the biggest impact on people's lives too.
Well, and I think what you're saying that's such a, like, valuable pearl is that he listened and he learned, and then, like, once he heard what you were saying, like, it was so enlightening to him to have that knowledge. And so that's the one thing that I love about nutrition, is that my patients that come to me who want answers, who are confused and who just want to know the truth, like, to see them understand the fundamental basics and be able to hold on to that and then not need me anymore, because they can just walk out and, like, live their lives eating real food, is so welcoming. Like, I love seeing that, you know, where there's some fields where, you know, if it is like oncology or like renal failure in different patients, you know, they do need that 24/7 care and access to a dietitian. But for us, like, there's patients that I see that I give them the tools that they need, and then they're just, like, free to go once they know the truth that they've never had before.
Right. I'm really glad you said that too, because I know this is probably the same for you. And for me, my goal as a nutritionist or Whole30 coach or whatever it is and how I'm working with people is to only work with you for a set amount of time. Because I yes. don't, if I am working with you forever, I mean, sure, I'll be making money, but I haven't done my job and I'm doing a disservice to you, you know?
Yes. And that independence and freedom. So, you know, like the type one patients that I see on insulin pumps at the endocrinology clinic, yeah, I'll see them their whole life, but you know, it's more so checking, you know, their insulin and their meds and making sure that they're on the right track. And like, if we come out with an awesome new inhaled insulin, like Afrezza, that they can go to that. But my patients that I see privately, like I give them these tools and these this knowledge packet, and then we meet a few times, but I've seen patients like up to a year at most. And that's my severe patients where, you know, 3 to 6 months seems to be like a really good amount of time for them to understand what's going on, apply it, master it, and then they're good.
Right. So then in kind of the other facet of your business that you have, what made you want to become a Whole30 coach?
So that came really out of nowhere. I was still working in the hospital and I was doing some private practice work, but I was really nervous to go out on my own. And I met a local Whole30 coach, Andrea Overturf, and we're the Dallas Whole30 duo now, and we're like at each other's hip like 24/7. But she reached out to me looking for someone to refer patient or clients to as a patient for me. After she was their Whole30 coach, she was going through like the beta version with Danica and like Real Food RDs, and she was like one of the first five. And I was really kind of hesitant at first. I was like, who's this blogger reaching out to me? Like, we've met like one or two times. Like, I was not involved in social media at all or in that kind of like Dallas bubble. And you know, she was like, I really want a dietitian to be able to work with. And she's like, I actually think that this might be something that you might enjoy. Like, they, you know, are looking for practitioners. And I had been eating and following, you know, Whole30 stuff for a while because that was like naturally the food that made me feel good and that worked with my diet. And so it seemed right for me to pursue just because Whole30 was so trendy and even now is still so trendy. And if for me, I felt like it was one more way that I could meet patients and get to know people and educate people with them without them feeling uncomfortable to talk to a dietitian, which is what I ran into all the time. People feeling like really just like awkward about making an appointment with me or meeting with me, and that maybe this would kind of give me more like street cred.
Right. No, I get the same thing. And I think, I don't know why, but I think for some reason, you know, the title nutritionist seems less scary than a dietitian. Yes, right. But I still feel that hesitation from a lot of people that I don't think they're intimidated to work with us, but you know, they might assume that, oh, you're a nutritionist, you're going to put me on this, you know, or you're a dietitian, you're going to put me on a restricted calorie diet, and it's going to be a lot of low fat and like lower protein. Diet. And exactly. Which is exactly the opposite of what we are teaching people and giving people. And honestly, it's what we're trying to teach them to unlearn as well. So I had the same thought when becoming a Whole30 coach. I was like, okay, this will be, you know, good to be exposed to more people because, I mean, I find, and you've probably found the same thing, is that as Whole30 coaches with a different background, with an RD and as a nutritionist, for us, I feel like with the tools that we've been prepared with, it's so much more important for us not just to take people through the Whole30 because, you know, compared to what comes afterwards, doing the Whole30 is much easier because the hardest part for me and what I've learned with working with a bunch of clients over the past year of being a Whole30 coach is food freedom and reintroduction is so, so much harder than the Whole30 itself.
Yes. And the one thing that, you know, you bringing that up is the emotional component of Whole30 is the hard part. And most diets do not address the emotional relationship to food. And Whole30 was the first time that someone said, like, hey, The sugar craving you're having has nothing to do with your lack of self-control and your physical ability or inability. It's an emotional thing, and that it's okay to have that, but you can gain support, you know, from a dietitian or from a nutritionist. And I think that for so long, a lot of our culture and, you know, old diet theory was kind of on like your, you know, physical food intake and not the emotional side. And so now I think what it opens up for me is talking to patients that are doing Whole30, saying like, hey, I see that you say this is really emotional, and this is what I work with my patients on after Whole30 is the food freedom, and that there is an emotional component, and that, you know, we work with that too.
Right. So is that something you guys do in your Dallas Duo group?
We do a lot on food freedom and a lot on reintroduction. We include that portion in our group, and we really make sure that people understand that the reason they do Whole30 is that they do reintroduction and that they do find food freedom, that Whole30 is not a diet. It is not just 30 days, that extra 10 days at least is included. And then we offer a discount for patients to follow up with me even the following month after to make sure that they really understand what they're going through and to complete food freedom effectively, because all the patients that I see are, you know, kind of in that stage. Like, I figured out what worked for me in the Whole30 setting, but how do I do this for the rest of my life?
Right. I just realized, I think we should back up a little bit and say, like, what is the Dallas Duo group coaching program? Yes. Because if people don't know, they're probably like, what the heck are they talking about?
Yes. So after I completed my Whole30 coaching certification, that was like August. So I think I was like the first, I don't know, 15 or something like that, mm-hmm. or maybe like 20. I decided that I didn't want to do one-on-one coaching because that was kind of similar to, I don't know, it was like too similar to what I do. You know, I'm like dietitian. I didn't want to do one-on-one coaching with people, but I really liked community and group settings. I wanted people to get over the fact that it was okay to like struggle. It was okay to do the Whole30 reset and that there's power in numbers. And so Andrea and I decided, since she is not dietitian, not clinical, but that she had all this wealth of knowledge from like her passive disordered eating and just being in Whole30 as a mom and as a wife, that we would pair together and have like a clinical, non-clinical duo team, very similar to what you and Kate have now. Mm-hmm. And so we offer 3 Whole30 group coaching events a year, and they're super social. We have brunches and we have curated workouts and we have coaching sessions and we meet up and we just like air everything out in public and in a community setting and make it easier to not have that like isolated diet culture.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what do you think their favorite things are about the group, and what do you think are the things that they benefit from the most?
Ooh, the favorite thing I think is people get really cozy with each other really quickly in like uncomfortable settings. Like, if you know that somebody else is experiencing the same thing as you, they build that relationship so much quicker. So we had women, we were laughing, like we would plan an event, but like they had already planned something to do together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, oh, we're busy, like we're hanging out together doing something else. And we're like, oh, okay. And so that like instant friendship that comes from having like a similar scenario. And then, you know, like 80% of our group is usually women, and it was really cool to see people pick up on the emotional concept so quickly and mm-hmm. be able to say like, I am struggling with this emotionally, and to be able to share that and have other people agree that they were also experiencing that same thing, and for it to not just be like a physical thing. Like, we had so many more non-scale victories shared and people talking about how much better they felt versus how much they looked. And in a culture of like, Dallas is very similar to like Beverly Hills, like we're very like fashion forward and people are very into what they look like and plastic surgery, and like if you're not a zero, you're a double zero. And we had none of that. We had like so much emotional repair in our group.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think it's so important. I actually went on a rant about this on Instagram stories a couple of days ago.
Yes, Rant City.
Yeah, exactly. Rant City USA. But so I was talking about how, you know, when we do these group coaching programs or whether you're doing individual Whole30 coaching or nutrition or anything, I get a lot of questions on why do you charge for the group program when the Whole30 is free? And the funny thing is I get this question a lot from people who have never made it through the program before. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I like to tell them is, you know, if you could do it by yourself, you could have done it, you know, like not to be mean or anything, but there's a thing about having accountability and community, whether it's from a group coaching program, especially, or it's from paying an individual Whole30 coach or paying for the membership to that group, because it's kind of like a gym membership. If you are paying, let's say, $250 a month to go to a CrossFit gym, you're probably going to feel a little bit of incentive to go there. But if you have a gym right next to your house and it's free, you probably won't use it as much.
Well, and in the same aspect, I think I tell people, like, hey, if you can do the Whole30 without a coach, do it. Great. Awesome. You're right. It is free. Like, that's how I did my first one. But did I feel better when I did it with a group? Yeah, 100%. Like, the time that I've done it with my own coaching group, it was so enlightening to see how much more I learned in a community setting than I did when I did it alone. But like you're saying, if you can do it alone, like, power to you, you know, no problem. That's great. But those aren't the people that we're here for. You know, the accountability is what we do in our 9 to 5 and in, you know, as a Whole30 coach.
Right. And then I think the biggest thing, since we've been talking about this a lot, is, I mean, I did plenty of Whole30s on my own and I did them with my CrossFit gym, but I never learned truly about the food freedom and reintroduction piece until I did it with people that were certified. And I mean, this was also me, like, going through schooling before doing the Whole30 coaching program and, like, while I was doing different Whole30s. But if food freedom is the thing that you struggle with the most, if reintroduction is the thing that you struggle with the most, that's where the accountability and the community and the support of having other people, whether it's a one-on-one or it's a group, is so important, because no one knows your body better than you, but it's so hard at the same time to be objective about the feelings that you're having about food, about figuring out, is this a symptom that's coming from a food that I ate, or I'm just feeling crappy today? I don't really know. So it really helps to have other people to ask questions to, other people that are going through the same thing, and licensed clinicians who are actually trained to take you through this to get you to the other side and feeling really good, so you can establish what food freedom looks for you, so you don't have to do Whole30s all the time.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, really interesting and a really good point, is that Whole30 has become a diet modification. So a lot of people will tell me, oh, I eat Whole30, or like, I eat Whole30 all the time. Like, it's almost like vegan or vegetarian. Like, they've made it a lifestyle, you know, and Whole30 all the time is like, if that's Whole30 food freedom, great. But we do not expect, and it's not good, you know, or foreseen, that you eat a Whole30 reset style for the rest of your life. That is not what it's for. It is a reset. But there is this group of people who don't reintroduce and don't do food freedom because they feel so good during Whole30 and there's no one there. There's no coach saying that, like, this is what comes next, for them to truly understand that it's not feasible to eat that way for the rest of your life. You know, it's just as restrictive as any other diet in the long run, if you're unable to kind of tease out, you know, what works for you and what doesn't.
Right. I could rant about this for hours. And I know you could too. We were talking about this, for all the listeners, we were ranting about this when we finally met in person at the Whole30 conference a couple of weeks ago. And that's how we knew we were going to be friends.
Because as we were drinking our, like, tequila soda.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And that's the other thing. I know you emailed me about this a while ago and I just saw it. I was ranting about how, you know, the Whole30 is a lifestyle, but that doesn't mean you have to eat strict Whole30 forever, right? That's the basis.
I think I replied to one of your newsletters, like, great. Right.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I just saw it this morning. And so, I mean, this is another funny thing that people assume about nutritionists and dietitians and, you know, whether you're a Whole30 coach, they kind of assume that you eat what you prescribe all the time. So for Whole30 yes. coaches, they're like, oh, don't you eat Whole30 all the time? I'm like, absolutely not. Like,
no, as I'm like shoving not. My face into a muffin. No.
Exactly. Yeah. A muffin or like having like a cocktail when we're at the Whole30 coaches conference or, you yes. know, a cookie every once in a while, God forbid.
Yeah.
But that's all yeah, part of no, food
it
freedom.
Is, it is really funny. You know, to get that feedback. And I think, you know, I have clients. So like, I mean, to bring up like a really bad topic is I reviewed like the RX bar nut butter, you know, it was just saying like, this is sex with your pants on in terms of Whole30. Like I wouldn't eat this. And people mm-hmm. were like enraged, oh, you know, gosh. How dare I say that like a, you know, date mixed nut butter was not approved. But then I'll make like, you know, lemon like paleo cookies for my husband's lunch and I'll have two and people are like, oh, I want the recipe. Oh, I want the recipe. Because it's like the setting, you know, yeah. like when it's appropriate for me to talk about cookies and when it's like not appropriate for me to talk about sugar. It's really interesting how people kind of engage with you based on the setting.
Oh so. My gosh. Yeah. Well, okay. I know you have a lot of other patients to get to today.
I do. Just 9. It's fine.
Just 9. Oh my God. But before I let you go, definitely tell people where they can find you for individual clinical nutrition stuff and for the Dallas Duo. If you're anywhere in Texas, I mean, not if you're like 7 hours away, but if you're anywhere in the Dallas area, you should definitely go join their Whole30 group.
Dana like doesn't understand how big Texas is.
No, I have absolutely like, no idea. Anywhere in Texas, I know it's a big but state.
Like not. yes, so the Whole30 Dallas Duo kicks off this September. We are starting after Labor Day, and so we're starting officially the 10th. Our kickoff is the 8th. If you're interested at all, you can check us out at whole30dallasduo.com, or you can follow myself, Witness Nutrition, WHIT, or Andrea, Lubies and Lulu, on Instagram, social media, all those things to find out more. And then Witness Nutrition is my holistic practice, and I really focus on just getting people to eat real food and to find bliss and freedom for the rest of their life.
I love it. And then last thing that I've really been enjoying asking all of my guests is,
yeah,
what is the most influential book that you have read recently? So it can be in the health space, it could be self-improvement, okay. It could yeah. be, you know, anything.
Yeah, so I recently read The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F.
Oh, you can say fuck on this podcast, it's fine.
Yeah, for sure. Well, like, I can't because my mom's going to listen to this, but you can. I read that, and I gave it to my parents to read. It was one of those books that I think that, like, I really struggle with, like, being seen a certain way and being perceived a certain way and for people to like everyone to like me and to always be in a good situation. And that book was just like finally something that was like, hey, no, like, you know, do you and like don't be ashamed of that. And that book was a really good stepping stone for that. And I've read some since then, but that I think kind of started that journey for me.
I love that book. I kind of had the same thing because I my whole life I've been such a yes person, such a
yes,
not necessarily a people pleaser, but you know, I always say yes to work obligations, social obligations, whatever, before I say no. And I've found in the past couple of years that I need to start saying no more and not caring about what people think when I say no, because it's a self-care practice. And as a practitioner, you can't pour from an empty cup. You have to take care of yourself first.
Yes. And like the Misadventures of like Disappointment Panda was like my favorite. Like the fact like it just like really brought things together for me of being that person to say it's okay to say no.
Yes, exactly. So I will link that book in the show notes for you guys and everything about Dallas Duo and Whitney. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes, and come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes.